From the Sky News Centre at 6. There are calls for a Labour official to be kicked out of the party for comments he was recorded making about anti-Semitism. Peter Wilsman was taped claiming the Israeli embassy was behind the crisis within the party. He's facing an internal investigation and has been suspended. Ex-spin Dr. Alistair Campbell says he received a swifter sanction from the party for admitting to voting for the Lib Dems.
If it's somebody like me that is considered to be not one of Jeremy Corbyn's people, then you get what seems like pretty summary justice. And if you're somebody who is clearly very close to Mr. Corbyn, then you get to sit on the National Executive.
A theme park in North Yorkshire says it's devastated. A boy who fell from a roller coaster is now said to be in a critical condition. Police say the seven-year-old had injuries which weren't immediately apparent yesterday. A head teacher who used funds to build a sex dungeon alongside his office has been banned from teaching for life. 74-year-old James Stewart was convicted of fraud and misconduct in public office for offences in 3 years until he left his school in Cambridgeshire in 2014. Business tycoon Sir Philip Green's been ordered to inject another £50 million into the pension fund of his Arcadia Group. He's being warned by regulators more money's needed or his retail empire will collapse. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
More information.
Celebrating diversity. This is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And Henry Palmer has written a book on gentrification here in Bristol. After the 7 o'clock news, the secret rulers of the world meeting in Montreux, Switzerland, right now. And the world only found out where the Bond Villains Convention was taking place this Tuesday morning. When, by coincidence, the strongest Swiss earthquake for the last 2 years, 4.2 on the Richter scale, hit at 10 to 11 in the morning just outside the city of Montreux. Financial tsunami to hit the euro-dollar zone? Well, who knows, with global repercussions, as well as getting an illegal war started with Iran, which will hopefully drag in, from their point of view, hopefully anyway, all the main superpowers on this year's unofficial agenda at Bilderberg in Montreux. Would you have the microchip from your contactless payment card implanted in your hand? What if the Mark of the Beast gave you a discount on all the transactions like petrol, your daily train and bus fares? Would you willingly take the mark? And what happens if you change your mind? Could you get it out? We go to listen to Brett Scott, author of The Heretic's Guide to Global Finance, Hacking the Future of Money, to look at where fintech, financial technology firms, are taking us without actually asking anyone, but our MPs or the press. And Skull and Bones author Chris Mulligan on how the secret societies control the world and have been for centuries, according to him, by taking over just a tiny number of key industries. Apparently they can control us all. And we go live to the scene of the crime, the Bilderberg Conference in Switzerland, and to the Black Sea, where one of the first commentators revealed on Monday evening, just 2 days before it started, where the 2019 Bilderberg meeting would be taking place. That's all in the second hour after the Comcast news at 7. Onto our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 11 and dry this weekend, 24 degrees Celsius. Very embarrassing. Last week, I said that the bank holiday was this weekend, not last weekend. Sorry about that, folks. I hope no one takes everything we say here seriously. And I do try and make sure I correct myself when I make silly mistakes like that. But I did Google it. It's my own stupid fault, isn't it? So cloud cover and rain this weekend. Sunny and warm tomorrow. Cooler with light rain on Sunday. Next week, highs of 18 Celsius. Some sunny spells and some showers next week. Next weekend, the 8th and 9th of June. Yes, it really is, folks. A high of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Now, we were supposed to be being joined by Mahmudur Khan, or Sultan Khan, who's a Eastville former Labour councillor, to discuss partly why he's not a Labour councillor anymore, which is all to do with the Labour Party's apparent attempts to replace him with an intern from the Labour MP Kerry McCarthy's office. That's at least what he told me earlier this week. I'm still hoping he'll phone in. I'll keep trying to remind him. But anyway, in the meantime, Martin Summers, we just heard more in the news there about the anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. This is something that Jeremy Corbyn is simply not dealing with, isn't it?
Well, I think Wilsman was basically, he was speaking off the record to an Israeli journalist, and he said that he thought that the Israeli embassy were added in for Jeremy Corbyn, and that's apparently anti-Semitic, although the Al Jazeera sting, which took place a couple of years ago now, we had the Mossad officer from the embassy talking to a Labour MP saying we've got £1 million to spend on steering the Labour Party in the right direction.
And well, of course, that programme's never been shown here. It's called The Lobby. I mean, it's not a serious programme, is it? This is Al Jazeera, some tin pot state.
Well, it doesn't really matter. I mean, the fact is, it's on the record, and the Israelis then had to withdraw him from the country, and he said we're going to try and get rid of Alan Duncan, who's a Tory minister. He said we don't like him, we're going to get rid of him, and we've got £1 million to spend in the Labour Party to make sure they do what we want. And that was, you know, basically that's all bang to rights. So I think it's absurd for anybody to say but maybe we need a statement from the Israeli embassy in support of Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah, if they say Jeremy Corbyn's a great guy, then the Israeli embassy wouldn't have any questions to answer, would it?
I've just been scouting around the news wires, and there's no statement from the Israeli embassy in support of
Jeremy Corbyn. Well, that was a bit of a facetious remark, because in actual fact we know very well that they've got it in for him, and there's overwhelming evidence that they have.
Okay, so the news is that Pete Wilsman, the Labour, has suspended the National Executive Member over these anti-Semitic remarks. Now, this is not put it by the BBC as whether these marks are anti-Semitic or not. There's no quote marks around that. So the BBC are saying these remarks are definitely anti-Semitic.
Well, they can say what they like. I mean, ultimately, there's going to have to be... freedom of speech demands that people are allowed to say what they like. I mean, are we not allowed to criticise the Israeli government?
What they're saying is it's a conspiracy theory he's coming out with, that the Israeli embassy is almost certainly behind the Labour anti-Semitism row.
Well, I think there's a whole stack of evidence to suggest that that's exactly the case.
Just going through some of that evidence. You mentioned that.
Well, we've got the evidence where the Israeli embassy withdrew I've forgotten the name of the officer. They withdrew immediately because he was caught red-handed saying exactly that we're going to try and
I think it's Shai Massot you're talking about.
Yep. I mean, I think we can put a link up on the show page to people to the clip. It's out there. It's been broadcast all over the world. And, they're bang to rights,
so
basically.
Let me just read out the quote. He is accused of saying, this is off the record. It's almost certain who is behind all this anti-Semitism against Jeremy Corbyn. Almost certainly it's the Israeli embassy. Well, I mean, he's saying this. I don't quite see why that is anti-Semitic to accuse the Israeli embassy of it. And they're saying that he's saying that because he doesn't like Jews and he's actually biased against Jews.
Well, I mean, he's already made a statement, I believe, saying that I've got nothing against Jewish people in general. This is all silly. But, of course, ultimately... When we went to war with Serbia in the 1990s, Tony Blair could have been accused of being anti-Serbian, couldn't he? He's been anti-Serbian because he's against their policy of trying to take over Kosovo, and we've gone to war with them to stop them. Is that anti-Serbianism? I think it is anti-Serbianism, isn't it? And I bet you the Serbian embassy had got it in for him as well, hadn't they?
Now, we've got author Henry Palmer here sitting very patiently waiting. We'll be talking to you, Henry, in a minute about gentrification here in the city. But I think it would probably better start by having a listen to... There's a chap called Norman Finkelstein, Martin, who wrote a book many years ago called The Holocaust Industry, and even though he's Jewish, Israeli born, brought up in Israel, he has been himself accused of being anti-Semitic for that book.
Yes, I know.
What do you know about Norman?
Well, I mean, he's basically hated by the Israeli government because he's one of their severest critics, and they don't like him at all, even though he's Jewish. But there you go, he must be anti-Semitic because he's against the government of Israel.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to what Norman Finkelstein had to say about the Labour anti-Semitism scandal. He says that it may backfire on the Jewish left.
Since the 1970s, every time Israel faces a public relations debacle, they start up with the new anti-Semitism. And it's totally predictable that since Corbyn is known to be sympathetic to the rights of Palestinians, they would start up a new anti-Semitism campaign. That was a given. But there is a variable, and it's very interesting what happened. What happened was, usually these campaigns, since they bear only on Israel, they're spearheaded by the Jewish organizations. But something different happened this time. Corbyn, he did not present a threat only to Israel and Israel's supporters. He posed a threat to the whole British elite across the board, from the Guardian to the Daily Mail. They all joined in the new anti-Semitism campaign. Now that's unprecedented. The entire British elite joined this whole completely contrived, fabricated, absurd and obscene assault on this alleged labor anti-Semitism, of which there's exactly zero evidence. Zero. Yeah, there are some fringe members of labor who are, you know, play into anti-Semitic.
When people hear that and understand where you're coming from, they'll say, but hang on.
I'm not talking about me.
But you've got a vested interest
there
because of...
That's totally ridiculous. I read the polls. It hovers between 6% and 8%. Are hardened anti-Semites in British society. It's nothing. Yeah, so there are a few crazies, but there's no institutionalized anti-Semitism in the British Labour Party. There's no threat of anti-Semitism in British society. I've read all the data. I've studied it closely. It just doesn't exist. It's all being designed and manipulated. I don't believe in conspiracy theories, as you know, but this is a conspiracy.
But there are Jewish people, and you have to recognise them, in the UK who are terribly worried about this. Because ultimately, if this anti-Semitism, which is what you're saying is used for political gain, doesn't work, when real anti-Semitism takes hold, then it's going to be back to the boy that cried wolf, and actually there's no protection for...
Well, there's a bigger problem than that. There's the boy who cried wolf, but I think there's a bigger problem than that. If Corbyn loses, a lot of people in the Labour Party are going to blame it on those Jews who fabricated this whole anti-Semitism witch hunt hysteria. And that will be a problem, but you know what the bigger problem there is? It's true! Jews were the spearhead of this campaign to stop Corbyn. And so there's going to be a lot of anger within the Labour Party. That's not anti-Semitism. Factually based.
But it wasn't just these Jews that you're talking about.
Yes, but they played the most visible role, and they played the most aggressive role. The British elites could not have gotten away with calling Corbyn anti-Semite unless they had the support, the visible support, of all the leading Jewish organizations. You have to remember that during the summer, all three major British publications, for the first time in British Jewish history, they all took out a common editorial denouncing Corbyn as an anti-Semite and saying that we're now standing on the verge of another Holocaust. They are the enablers of this concerted conspiracy by the whole of British elite society to destroy Jeremy Corbyn.
My name is Deborah Maccabee, and I'm a member of Jewish Voice for Labour, which is a group within Labour set up by Jews to counter false accusations of anti-Semitism that are levelled against Jeremy Corbyn. It started when Corbyn was still a candidate for leadership, when he suddenly began to shoot up in the polls and it became clear that he had a real chance of winning. And that was when the Jewish Chronicle began a campaign against him. The Jewish community leaders don't want him to become Prime Minister, partly because he has always supported Palestinian rights. He said quite clearly he supports a two-state solution. The Jewish community don't want this to happen. I find it hard to understand, because surely the best way that Israel can be secure is if it has secure, recognised borders. The Jewish community are afraid that the whole British foreign policy will be overturned by Corbyn. There's so much focus on this idea that Corbyn is a danger to democracy. And meanwhile, the real danger of the far right, the rise of the far right, is being ignored.
Well, another danger, Martin Summers, is that there may be a war in the Middle East too, mightn't there?
Well, there's going to be one. There's already wars raging across the Middle East, as we know. It's the question is if we're going to get any bigger. And of course, we have been to war with Israel, just as we went to war with Serbia in the 1940s. The current leadership of Israel were killing British soldiers. Would it be anti-Semitic to accuse them of being terrorists? I don't know.
Well, what do you think about what Norman was saying there about what's going on in the Labour Party? He's saying there could be an enormous backlash if Jeremy Corbyn is seen to be unelectable because of what some of its members are doing.
Well, I think it's interesting that Jewish Voice for Labour have been formed, and I think they've done a very good job, because basically they're appalled by what's going on, and the Board of Deputies of British Jews, which were attacking Corbyn, they're all Tory voters. They're all Tory voters. And so they said, we don't trust the Labour Party anymore. Well, you're not in the Labour Party. At one stage, they were saying they wanted an ombudsman that they would appoint to decide who and who was not an anti-Semite in the Labour Party. And you just say, hang on a minute, we've got a rule book here. And, you know, you can't have an outside ombudsman from a self-appointed group of Jews to decide what is and what is not anti-Semitic. And, of course, we're probably going to war with Iran, in which case we are going to war politically with Israel. We're going to have, ultimately, the state of Israel
what
has not...
What do you mean by we're going to war politically with
The state of Israel was given a boundary in 1948, and they've never stayed within that boundary. Now, when the Serbs tried to take over Bosnia, when the Serbs tried to take over Kosovo, we went to war with them. There was a 73-day bombing campaign which killed 10,000 people, mostly civilians, and it was all cheered on by the media, and Tony Blair was the Prime Minister at the time, and all the establishment press said it was good. The Serbs had to be told that they couldn't. Do you know who didn't support the intervention over Kosovo? Ariel Sharon, who was the Prime Minister of Israel, because he understood immediately what this R2P thing could be. If we're going to intervene without United Nations backing to save Muslims from being murdered in Kosovo, then why can't we do the same thing in Gaza? Okay, let's put in a no-fly zone.
Finally, on this,
shoot down their pilots.
On this story today about Pete Wilsman, who's on the Labour National Executive, he's accused of saying, this is off the record, it's almost certain who is behind all this anti-Semitism against Jeremy Corbyn. Almost certainly it's the Israeli embassy. The remarks were recorded in January during a meeting between Mr. Wilsman and the American-Israeli author Tuvia Tenborn in a hotel in Oxford. Mr. Tenborn told the BBC.
So, in other words, basically, what's this guy's relationship with the Israeli embassy? I mean, has he got any relationship? We don't know, do we?
Well, maybe you're anti-Semitic drawing those conclusions.
Well, I'm afraid if we're going to have arguments about this, then we're going to have arguments about it. I was an aid worker in Bosnia during the war in the 1990s, and ultimately I supported NATO intervention against Serbia. Does that make me an anti-Serbian? No, it makes me a political animal. And, of course, the same is true of the Israelis. If you want to carry on annexing the Golan Heights, if you want to carry on killing the Gazans, ultimately I'm not a pacifist. Somebody will have to go to war with you and teach you a lesson, won't they? Like Slobodan Milosevic was taught a lesson. Benjamin Netanyahu will have to be taught the same lesson. Take him to the International Criminal Court.
Well, you may have heard a little bit of coughing there. That's Sultan Khan, who's on the line joining us. Thanks, Sultan. You're now an independent councillor for Eastville. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Can you give us your views on this? I understand you're a Muslim. In fact, I think you're going through Ramadan at the moment. What you make of this row that's been going on within the Labour Party? I mean, just stressing that you are actually not formally a Labour councillor anymore, are you?
I'm not a Labour councillor anymore. I'm an independent at the moment. Look, in regards to this anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and all this, I don't want to go on to saying who done what and why we are in this situation. I think we know, despite of numerous United Nations resolutions and so on, we are still where we are in terms of Palestine and Israel. And I think the world leaders are failing Israel, they're not failing Palestine, they're failing humanity. They're not serving humanity. They come to powers, they use certain, you know, like certain steps, these political ladders that created in the world I mean, Palestine, Israel, and these Middle Eastern issues, and all of these African issues, that helps some of these people. But basically, we are not serving humanity. Before you and me, Jewish, Christian, Muslims, and all this, we are human. And if you look at, I mean, I don't want to go into specifically what Jeremy Corbyn and his party and all this are doing. But personally, I think a lady, I was listening, that lady said that how the Jewish support group was formed and all this, and to support Jeremy Corbyn. And she very clearly said what they believed and why they came forward to help Jeremy Corbyn and so on. So that's put aside. But I think, you know, without a two-state, and I think Martin, your other commentator, other participant has also mentioned that what happened is happened, has happened. We need to deal with it. And as I said, and unless we deal with Labour Party, Conservative Party, Lib Dem, all of these parties here, unless they deal with these things proactively, we will always remain where we are. And these issues will come again and again and again. But as long as we human will live on this planet, issues will remain. But unless and until we do it, we deal with it, it will be viral. And
what about this whole dispute about the one state and two state solution? Jeremy Corbyn has put himself very firmly behind a two state solution.
Without a two state solution, there is no peace in Palestine and Israel. And if there is no peace in Palestine and Israel, there is no peace in Middle East. If there is no peace in Middle East, there is no peace in European and American nations. How could you deny that? How could we deny that?
Anyway, look at the
situation in Middle East now. We have millions and millions and millions of people displaced today. They are so-called refugees, and from those people there are some so-called terrorists and so on and all this. This all linked to, it all goes back to the policies of European nations. I'm not saying one nation, or I'm not talking about just one country of our country or which country. We have failed. The politicians have failed. The system has failed humanity. You know, and I think it's important that those whoever is in the power in our country, in UK or in other European nations, they really need to look into this from the perspective of humanity. Look at the people in Palestine and in Gaza and other parts of Palestine.
Now, Martin,
today,
Martin Summers, Jeremy Corbyn's put himself very firmly behind this whole thing of the two-state solution. And actually, this new thing that the Americans are coming up with, the deal of the century, they call it, apparently not a one-state solution.
Well, I think what's actually happening on the Palestinian side is they're coming round to say there's no two-state solution to be had here. And ultimately, of course, you could have a situation where the state of Israel is de-recognised as an independent state. Kosovo is still not recognised as an independent state inside the United Nations. And ultimately, if the Israelis aren't going to fulfil UN resolutions, then ultimately their status as a state could be removed.
Is Jared Kushner and the Israel lobby going to allow that?
Well, of course not. I mean, what's actually happening is they're preparing for a war so that they can have a greater Israel, Eretz Israel, as they call it. They're about to annex the West Bank, which they've got no right to do whatsoever. And, of course, when Serbia tried that on in the 1990s, the RAF bombed their TV stations and killed their weather girls.
Sultan Khan, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Martin has said all this, why this American deal of century, you know, this guy is in White House. I mean, Lord helps him in his dealings in his country and in the foreign affairs. What a chaos we have seen and we've been seeing in the world today. And his son-in-law, without any credibility, without any credibility, any understanding of foreign policy, and any understanding of geopolitical issues, this guy has become the deal maker now. And unfortunately, the deal is in front of everybody, as Martin said, and you all know. It will not be, and I suppose the Palestinian will not buy into it, and therefore there will be continuous fight and annexation and all of these things.
Well, it sounds like a continuation of the old peace process, which actually never brings about peace. Anyway, look, listen, let's just draw a line under talking about the Labour anti-Semitism row and what's going on in Palestine and Israel right now, and come a bit back down to earth, Sultan Khan, because you're no longer a member of the Labour Party. I wonder if you could just give us your version of events of why that is.
Well, I mean, I had a bit of an issue locally. There's a lot of infighting goes on, as you understand, in politics.
Well, I mean, that's a big decision to make, isn't it? And also, some would say it's a betrayal of the people that voted for you. They voted for a Labour councillor, and you've decided to go off on your own.
Thank you for giving me for asking this question. Historically, in Eastville, Labour didn't have a councillor for decades. So when I stood in Eastville, the historically Labour Party was getting about 700-800 votes, 600-700 for many decades. When I stood, worked hard really, and supported by, of course, the branch, I increased the majority to 1,450 something like vote. So from 700, 600 to all these. And then subsequently, a subsequent election, 2,500 and 2,400, 2,400 and something, so that three elections that I have stood in Eastville. And I can assure you that it's all not Labour Party member, it's all not Labour Party supporter. You cannot have such amount of vote just Labour Party members, from the Labour Party members and supporters. I had a cross-party support in that ward because I stand in the community. I worked for community for many years. I have been known in that area for many, many years. And when I started working, I put the message across. People accepted, and then I was elected, and I worked hard, continuously working hard, best I could. And therefore, it's not only Labour Party that supporters that elected me. It's the people of Eastville has elected me three times, and therefore I'm continue. I will continue to serve them as long as they want me to serve them. So it's not Labour Party who elected me; it's the people of Eastville who elected me.
But they elected you as part of the Labour Party, didn't they? They thought that you were standing on the Jeremy Corbyn ticket.
Well, I was a councillor before Jeremy Corbyn came in to being the leader of the party.
That's a good answer. But look, why did you make that decision? What sort of reason behind it?
Well, I mean, I realised that a few people were trying to plot something against me. I asked a few questions, and my questions were answered properly. And, you know, they were trying to bring in few people through the back door, through a process, but mostly...
Well, I mean, maybe to sideline you, you know, so this is obviously difficult, isn't it? If you've put a lot of effort into a political party and then someone comes along and said, actually, we want to replace you, that's not a very nice thing to hear, is it?
Well, I mean, if they had bold enough, if they were friends enough, if they were sincere enough and said to me, like, you've done nearly 10 years, do you think you want to... take a rest and look after your young family and so on, I would have said maybe yes. But since I realized that they were trying to stab my on my back, I thought, well, it's time to get up and fight on.
Well, well done anyway. I think politics is a dirty game, and it takes some courage to do what you've done, Sultan.
Well,
and,
I will never be a dirty politician. There are people, politics is a dirty game, and there are dirty politicians, but personally, this is not my motto. I've been in politics since the age of 12, 13. You know, conscious politically. And I will never be a dirty politician, I can assure you on that.
So what drives you in politics? What do you really in it for?
Well, I mean, like, just to serve people. You know, a couple of days ago, I was watching an interview by Barack Obama. and he was saying when he was an activist, he was going around and trying to do things for the community. And then when you get people together, you see that one group don't agree with other group and so on. So you think, it's a frustration. You can't get things done. So he thought, like, let's go to the next step, you know, try and get a little bit of power. So he goes to the state legislative assembly. So he gets a little bit of power. He goes there. He see, like, it's almost the same situation. You have people on two sides and all these sides, and they're not sort of coming together to do things. Then you think, like, okay, let's get a little bit of more power. Maybe I can do better. So you progress on that, and he became then the senator. And then he's in the same situation. You know, like, people are not, and then he thought, okay, well, I can't do much here because it's the same people, same thing happening. Let's get a little bit more power. So he stood for the presidency and he won. So it's all about trying to help your community where you are. And then there is steps that you have to take, you know, like, to get a little bit more power and all this. But what I enjoy being a councillor is, you know, sometimes, seven, 8 months ago, I had a call from a lady in my ward, and she said, Councillor Khan, I have this issue. Please, could you please look into it? So I looked into it and tried to help her. And then she called me back and said, thank you so much. It's resolved. But I wanted to tell you this as well. A few months back, you helped me with something else as well, and I'm so grateful to you. So these kind of things keeps you going and keeps you motivated to go forward and try and help people as best as you can.
Liberal Democrats this week have been claiming that Sajid Javid would be a danger to people in Bristol. This is an article in the Bristol Post. If he became Prime Minister, this is a Bristol chap that became Home Secretary and is now standing to be Tory leader. Mr. Javid, who grew up in Easton, is the Home Secretary and MP for Bromsgrove in Worcestershire, among the candidates to be the next Conservative leader. And
I can't comment on Liberal Democrats' comments or their whatever they're doing, saying. All I can say is, Sajid Javid is a soil-grown, homegrown person. He has done enormously for himself and for the country. As a Home Secretary, he's there. His point, well, at the moment, as we all know, that nothing much happening. But I have no, all I can say is best of luck to all of these candidates. And I suppose this is politics. You know, people will go about others, try and fulfill their own personal agenda or political or party agenda, but I'm not going to make any comments on what they said.
What about the reason for this Tory leadership election, which is Brexit? Where do you stand on this?
But I am a Remainer, and I think then Prime Minister, who is no longer in active politics, led us to a disaster. And few of these people who supported Leave and Leave campaign, and ultimately they succeeded. And look at where we are as a country. The financial market, the confidence level, you know, as a small businessman, I'm a small businessman, it's a huge struggle. It's a huge struggle. Because when there is lack of confidence in the market, lack of investment in the infrastructure, all of these things hamper your small business, and you struggle. You know, the whole chain is struggling. We know that, and I think it's important that these matters resolved sooner than any later.
Martin Summers, we've got this Tory leadership battle going on at the moment. One of the things that's come out as a result is discussions last week on Radio 4 and Radio 5 Live, various Conservative MPs saying that the go-to person to reach Theresa May and her Brexit negotiations was Philip May, her husband, that he was the guy that was organising a lot of that, and that there was no point in trying to call Theresa May and speak to her about it. She would just direct you to her husband. The only problem is, of course, her husband is a partner of some sort in something called Capital Group, which is a massive US investment firm. And just looking at that firm, they have they control most of the shares, or maybe it's just simply the largest proportion of shares of any specific group, Capital Group, having BAE Systems. I mean, the Russians revealed this, and so it's rather dangerous, isn't it, when you've got a husband who's doing this kind of financial trading where he actually stands to gain from your policies. So, for example, the bombing of Syria, Theresa May's husband's firm, Capital Group, made a lot of money on their BAE shares, probably tens of millions of pounds.
Yes, indeed. And of course, it's come out this week that the chemical weapons organisation from the, you know, OPCW, whatever it's called, the internal report was leaked, which showed that in actual fact the so-called chemical weapons attack at Douma was staged by the White Helmets. And in other words, we then fired missiles into Syria at hitting Syrian army positions and Russian army positions. Nobody was killed because basically they fired at places which they'd been agreed to fire at, which were empty. But of course, they would have been perfectly within their rights to fire back at the Akrotiri base in Cyprus, because the Cypriots, of course, don't want the British bases there. They've never wanted them there. They went to war with us in the 1950s to drive us out. Archbishop Makarios, General Grivas, killed plenty of British soldiers to get us out of there. And then we kept the bases. And they're absolutely furious that we are using their base to fire missiles at Syria. And of course, in actual fact, the Syrians would have been quite within their rights to fire back and kill as many British military personnel as they could get in that military base.
So what do you make of this sort of arrangement going on, Martin, in the top of British politics, where the husband, Philip May's Capital Group, is the largest shareholder in BAE Systems, and also that their shares were soaring since the Syrian airstrikes, and also that people have been told, you chat to him, don't talk to Theresa?
Well, that's because she doesn't seem to have any close friends, and he's her main advisor. And of course, this whole question of insider trading is very important for politicians. I mean, in the US, politicians are constantly engaged in insider trading because they know what's going to happen.
The company,
and then,
they
tell their dealers to take the appropriate steps.
His company's Capital Group is also the second largest shareholder in Lockheed Martin, the US military arms firm that supplies weapon systems, aircraft, and logistical support. And their shares have also rocketed since these Syrian airstrikes. But this is really a story from last year. But what I'm saying is it's interesting to me that a lot of these, apparently, the backbenchers were told, don't talk to Theresa, talk to Philip. Anyway, look, let's get back to Bristol now, because it's supposed to be the local and the national hour, the first hour of this programme. And I'm joined by Henry Palmer. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about your book, Henry, and what inspired you to make it?
So, hi, Sultan. I grew up in the ward of East, and just around the corner from where we are now, and I've recently wrote a book about the gentrification of Bristol.
What's it called?
It's called Voices of Bristol, Gentrification and Us. I'd be quite interested. I wrote it because I grew up in cosmopolitan working class Eastern, and when I came back from uni in 2016, there were all sorts of differences, both cultural and financial. But I'd be quite interested to hear Sultan's opinion on this, but specifically with regards to Sajid Javid. He received a backlash recently for having said that when he grew up on the Stapleton Road around that area, it was quite deprived, and he'd gone through some quite hard times. He's since received a massive backlash from the community, saying that he's out of touch, despite the Stapleton Road being the 11th most deprived road as recently as 2015, and Eastern indeed still being one of the most deprived wards in all the city. I'd be interested to hear what you have to say on this, Sultan.
What Sajid Javid said and what people said about him, that's on the record. And I think Sajid Javid could have been slightly Bushler articulated in his... because, look, if you talk about Eastern and surrounding area 20 years back, I suppose I would say it's in a slightly better position than it was. So you cannot, you know, like, deny that. Now you're having... yes, there are in huge increase of BME population in that area as well. But you have BME councillors, you have BME representative in the city council, you have, you know, like mayor living in Eastern, you have all of these people. I almost live in Eastern as well, though I live in the border. So I personally would not talk that low about Eastern and all this. I accept there are issues. I accept there are things that need to be done. But I won't, you know, I will not follow what Sajid said and the backlash and so on.
It's just like I felt it a bit excessive when I was reading about the backlash that I'd receive, because it didn't seem like a demonisation of the area. From having grown up in the area myself, it just seemed like an acknowledgement of what had been unfair deprivation.
Henry,
and
Henry, can you just tell us what is going on with gentrification? Certainly, I mean, I live in St Paul's. I'm seeing lots and lots of it. Isn't it inevitable? This is bound to happen.
Well,
people want to speculate. I mean, we often talk about developers, but actually many of them are just simply speculators. They'll hold on to a piece of land until they can see they can make some money, and then they'll make as much as they possibly can and leave.
Well, you have a lack of action coming from central government to force developers, for one thing, to build enough affordable home in any development. Sultan, and a lot of us will know about the chocolate factory development in Easton, which is now set for something like 130 private apartments, zero of which are affordable, which is totally unacceptable. Because,
but even affordable doesn't necessarily mean affordable,
no,
does it?
No, it doesn't. Since 2011, the changes in the classification, as advocated, by the way, by our potential new Prime Minister Boris Johnson, was that affordable is anything up to 80% of market rate, which is totally contrasting with past classifications of affordable. The fact is, gentrified areas, which are old working class areas, are more deprived. And in more deprived areas, you find people with less money. When people have less money, they're less able to afford to live in areas which are so-called up and coming. It leaves a bittersweet taste in the mouth for people who've had to grow up and everything else in these areas to then not be able to afford to live in them when they get older.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this whole idea of what's now becoming called social cleansing after this.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free, and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available if you have any questions. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
So I'm just going to ask Sultan Khan, he's the independent now, former Labour councillor for Eastville, what you make of this, and do you see it as a problem, as some people feeling that they cannot no longer afford to live in parts of Bristol, Sultan?
Well, look, we talked about what affordable and what not affordable. The government, I'm not talking about just Tory government, last government also, you know, this 10 years and year before, the Labour governments. I think during the Labour government's time, there was some house building projects and so on. We've seen some. I think John Prescott was, at some point in charge and so on. And there were quite a bit of improvement. But last 10 years especially, we have gone to this situation. Over the last 10 years, we have now, you see the homelessness over all this time. You see the income level has decreased. The value of the prices, value of the house has gone up. Therefore, And of course, the, you know, jobs market is so volatile. You know, people are struggling. As I said earlier on, as a small business owner, I see, you know, how society is.
But no, we all know these problems, but what to do about them, Sultan?
So basically to build houses. You know, we have to build houses, and we have not been building houses. Social houses has not been built over decades, you know. At the moment, I suppose, this in Bristol, if I just talk about, that Mayor has been working hard with Paul Smith to make a move on this. And I think they have so far, you know, in a reasonably good track, but it's not enough. We need to build houses. Central government need to be playing the role, proper role, not, you know, like a role that in inverted commas.
Well, we've also got one of the other things is we've got travellers, haven't we, on Bristol Common. They've been on Eastfield Park, etc. Isn't that,
yeah,
when it's so difficult to afford to rent or buy a home, surely, you know, travellers are bound to appear. Are people, you know, whether it's traditional travellers or people will have to start living in caravans, maybe on the canals, barges, or even in tents. We've got in one of the parks in St Paul's a couple of people living in tents now permanently.
That's it. And I had this issue in my ward last year, and I still have in the, you know, this is a continuous issue that this issue continue in my wards and around the city. And that it's not only just one element of why you see van dwellers and travelers and so on. There are multiple issues with that. So deprivation, there is lack of job opportunity, there is lack of housing, there is lack of there is mental health, there is all of these issues comes into playing the role that, you know, like then you see all of these caravans and so on. So and of course, as you said, people are buying second-hand boats and all this, and making homes, the canals and all this, they're making their homes.
I suppose I should speak to Martin actually about the macroeconomics of this. Martin, why is it the housing market so badly hit at the moment? It's almost as if for many people, they just don't have any disposable income anymore. But the one thing they do have to spend money on is their home, and they're having to spend more and more on it.
Yeah, well, many people on low incomes, of course, are spending more than half their income on rent. Effectively, if they can get anywhere to rent. But ultimately, this has very, very profound implications for the macroeconomy in Britain. We've basically built after the 2008 crash, we basically used quantitative easing and zero interest rates to push up a property bubble. And of course, in Britain, everybody thinks these property bubbles are normal, that, you know, you buy a house at the bottom and you just get free money from society as it gradually increases in value. But of course, in Germany, real house prices haven't risen in 40 or 50 years, and basically they concentrate all of their, when you go to posh parties in Germany, small business people will be talking about their latest business ventures, whereas of course in Britain they talk about what their house prices are. And in the 1980s, when I lived in London, people could make more money from their housing than they could from going to work in the city. This is just totally irrational. It's why we don't build better widgets, because we're too busy building conservatories.
Yes, yeah, no, and even Orwell, in recognising the Englishman's appreciation and of a home as a castle, didn't expect for the occupation of the landlord to become as ubiquitous as it has. After the right to buy policy in 1980, what you had was a sort of land grab, which has led to the inflation in rent prices, led to preposterous statistics like 40% of housing benefit going directly to private landlords now. And it also means that in Bristol, for example, where our council housing stock was about 33% in 1980, it's now reduced to 13%, which has profound and negative consequences for the housing market in the city.
Could you just remind us of the title of your book and explain why it's worth reading?
So the name of the book is Voices of Bristol, Gentrification and Us. And it looks at both the cultural and economic side of gentrification in Bristol. So cultural, for example, new premises opening up in working class areas like cafes, like cocktail bars. But it also looks at the economics of that. So it looks at the unaffordability of areas in which people grew up. And it looks at both cultural and economic marginalisation. It's worth reading because it's the accounts of real everyday people, which I've spoken to on the streets, as well as politicians from Kerry McCarthy to Councillor Paul Smith and further afield. And there's solutions provided at the end as to how we can reconcile the negatives of gentrification with the positives at the end.
Okay, so Henry Palmer, thanks very much for joining us. We're going to go on now to talk about a protest tomorrow, Martin Summers. Traffic warning as Extinction Rebellion are targeting city centre roads in a 5-hour protest, apparently taking over Cabot Circus, etc.
Well, I mean, I don't know anything about it, but people obviously feel strongly enough to do this. And obviously the Greens won overwhelmingly in the Euro election in Bristol. So these issues are very very much to the fore, aren't they?
A 5-hour protest will include everything from a pop-up catwalk to blocking this whole city centre traffic. So don't try driving around the city centre tomorrow. There's a warning for you, folks. Targeting Bristol's fashion and clothes stores, they look set to cause maximum disruption to Saturday afternoon shopping in the city centre. In December, more than 200 activists brought the inside of Cabot Circus to a standstill with a die-in. They're now promising this Saturday's action will be even bigger.
Well, I think this kind of action, if you're going to do something like that, you must make sure you've got leaflets to explain to it's about. When we had the big protests against the invasion of Iraq in 2003, but we took the city centre really was completely blocked. We had thousands of people, but we prepared in advance and we made sure we had loads and loads of leaflets to hand out to all of the cars, and so that people knew why they were in a traffic jam and they weren't just sitting in a traffic jam thinking what's going on. And of course you've got to be very careful about the way you carry out these kind of protests if you don't want to alienate people. You just got to think it through.
Sultan Khan, what do you make of this Extinction Rebellion movement, which apparently is ideologically started here in Bristol with a group called Rising Up and is now spreading around the world?
Well, it's all about how people feel. People's feelings, they feel strongly about it, but the issues, but I think, as we all know, I hope police will do their bits to, and those people who are coming to join the rebellion, I hope that they will be, they'll be calm and careful so that the city still can function. And I hope that they don't try and block everybody because the city need to go on to its own business, regular business,
So do you approve of what they're doing?
Sorry?
Do you approve of what they're doing?
Well, I mean, I don't approve, I don't disapprove. You know, what I would say is it's all about the issues and how people are feeling. So if the issue is they feel that they, as Martin said about the Iraq war and all this. So if the issue is something that mass people feel strongly about it, me personally approve or disapprove, it doesn't means a lot, but I mean, we see on our street nowadays these kind of repeat blockage in central London. We're going to be seen tomorrow in Bristol and other places, so as you said, across the world. It's all about issues, how people are affected, how me affected, my children affected, and next generation.
I mean, the main subtext of these demos is the politicians have failed again, like you were saying about the Middle East.
That's it. What politicians have, I'm a local politician, and politicians, there is no doubt about it, politicians have failed. Our society, our country, and if you just talk about our us as a nation and government, we failed in world as well.
So would big business do better? Should they take over?
Sorry, if...
Would big business do better than politicians? Should they be running the show?
No, of course not. Of course not. Politicians should do their job to run country and be politicians. But at the moment, we have derailed ourselves. We are not the politicians. There are some people who are mostly thinking about their own personal benefit and gains than real, people of the country and the structure and the generations, next generations to come.
Okay, so let's talk about a couple of other stories before the top of the hour. First of all, UK's first 5G network is going live in 6 cities tomorrow, but not here in Bristol. What do you think about 5G, Sultan?
Well, it's good for us. I don't know why it's not coming to Bristol, but there are some issues involved, as we hear that.
Some people say it's not being tested properly before it's being rolled out.
That's it. So I don't really know much about the intelligence and all this.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'll just play a little clip about it's one of the experts who knows a bit about, and this is guys Brett Scott. He's the author of this book all about the future of technology and the future of finance about 5G.
Think about the standard startup pitch format. If you ever go to any startup pitching contest, they always have this format, which is like, I've identified a problem. Here's my solution for the problem, and here's how you monetize the solution, right? And here's how you market this to people. This is what you tell them, the short-term use value of this thing, right? And that's the only thing that a venture capitalist is going to back, because that's the only thing you can sell in the short term, right? And so there's this whole sort of structure of capitalism which involves having to pitch short-term solutions. At an individual level, that might be fine. But when you start to like zoom out and you look at the collective effects of these things, you'll find people being locked into gigantic sort of systems that they do not understand. Our mobile phones are a very good example of this. These would be pitched as being, useful things, which they are, but just like, oh, by the way, we also created like a huge surveillance system to track every moment of your life in the process.
So yes, that is Martin. I mean, what do you make of this? This is another I suppose it's almost like the big tech companies aren't really thinking about ordinary people. They're just looking, making money.
Well, they are, but I think one of the things about 5G, if we look at all this fuss about Huawei and so on, it's got military implications. So both the Chinese and the Russians and the Americans are keen to develop 5G because they need it for military